call to order the Senate Committee on Legislative Operations and Reform. Thank you very much for coming today. This is open primary day at the Oregon State Legislature, and we have a number of people that are going to be talking to us about the proposal for opening up Oregon's primaries. Margie, why don't you give us a little...
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in your packet, along with your staff measure summary, I've included Initiative 86, which was filed for the last election cycle, and just the text of that initiative. And the reason for including that is the Public Commission on the Oregon Legislature, when they requested a draft for the open primary bill, which is now Senate Bill 53, we asked Legislative Council to base it on Initiative 86, minus a couple of sections that were controversial to members of the commission. Legislative Council also gave us a letter outlining some of the legal questions with the Senate Bill 53 draft. I believe that 53 and 630 are identical, so if there are legal problems with 53, then same legal problems exist with 630. So I just want to call your attention to that letter.
Okay, thank you very much, Marjorie. And at this time, we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 53 and Senate Bill 630 and call on Representative Cannon, who has joined us from over on the other side of the building. Ben, it's good to have you here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Ben Cannon, representing State Representative District 46 in parts of Portland. I appreciate being here. I have very brief and largely unprepared, thus brief, testimony in support of these Senate bills and this concept of open primary. And I really just want to tell a quick story, which is, I campaigned in District 46 in parts of southeast and northeast Portland. It is a district that, by voter registration, is about 50% Democrats, about 18% Republicans, a few percent other party, and then around 30% independent or non-affiliated. This meant, as in is typical in districts like mine, that the real election, certainly the competitive election, was in the primary. And because I was running as a Democrat, I went to Democratic households, which meant skipping a lot of doors. On a typical block, I would of 10 houses, I went to 4 or 5 of them, because in the others, you found those non-affiliated voters, you found Republicans, you found other party voters. I had no incentive to talk to them to win a Democratic primary. Now, after winning the Democratic primary, I did go back to some of those doors. There was still a general election campaign. But as you know, and as those voter registration statistics would indicate, it was not a particularly competitive election. I support the open primary largely because of that story. It felt wrong to me that it was only only registered Democrats in District 46 who really determined the outcome of their race and of who would become the state representative for that district. One could say in response to that, well, folks could register as Democrats if they want to play and have a say over who's going to be their legislator in an overwhelmingly Democratic district. I think that's not the policy message we want to send. I mean, it's one we do send. I think it's not a good one. I don't think we should be putting people into boxes in order to give them a voice in the electoral process. For me, this is about making politics more responsive to the public, and that means encouraging people to be involved, making sure they have a voice, making sure that voice is heard. And so for that very simple reason, I am very strongly in support of the open primary. I think you'll hear more from other witnesses about some of the sort of bigger theory and principles behind this kind of system. I support those, think it's a good one. And with that, I will conclude my testimony.
Other questions for the representative? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Girard, welcome to our committee.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you, Chair Monroe. I'm Representative Fred Girard. I represent District 17, and I'm the opposite of Representative Cannon here in the fact that my district is primarily Republican. I have a +9 registration edge, and I was here in 1993 when Phil Kiesling was Secretary of State, and I supported this measure in 93. I just think open primaries are a good thing for the public. And very similar to Representative Cannon, I think in my district it's determined more by the Republican primary, who gets the nod on the Republican side, because the edge is so much that whoever has that is going to probably be the electee. So in essence, both Representative Cannon and myself are probably asking for more opponents than less. And also there is a thing that I noticed, I have a little bit different reference in the fact that I was here in 93 and what's in 2007 here is that it has got far more partisan than what it was in 93. And so I think this would be something that would kind of bring us back to the middle a little bit more. So that's my testimony, short and sweet.
Thanks, Fred. Other questions for Representative Girard?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. Senator Ben Westland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee. For the record, Senator Ben Westland, District 27. You know, really, the fundamental issue before us today and before any representative democratic body and the effectiveness of that body is how well we elect people and how capable they are of representing their entire district, not just the party that elected them out of a primary, but how effective they are at representing the diverse and varied interests that are contained within my and all of our districts. That is the fundamental issue and the measure by which we should be judged and that democracy will be proved successful. As we go forward, and as we have all seen, in our closed primary system, the parties are given preferential advantage. And this is really about encouraging voter turnout. As you know very well, primary elections held and funded by all taxpayers do not allow participation of the fastest growing segment of the electorate, non-affiliated voters, otherwise known as independents. Something seems inherently unfair to me that we exclude nearly 25%, one in four voters in Oregon, from participating in a primary. And it seems even more unfair that they're asked to pay for the privilege of holding primary elections and not being allowed to participate. Is that truly democracy? I don't think so. Over the years, the principle of was originally one man, I'll say one person, one vote, has been longly established, and properly so in this country. But in our primary, in our closed primary structure, I don't believe that fundamental principle is adhered to. How can you exclude individuals from voting in the primary? You know, the answer is, well, all you have to do is join one of these parties or that party. No. Being a citizen, being a Democrat or Republican, is not a prerequisite for voting in our system. The prerequisite is being a registered voter. So I I don't say this to disparage parties in any way. Parties have a long and noble history and heritage in this country. They do great things. They encourage people to get involved. They find and nurture candidates. They articulate issues and positions. Parties aren't bad, but excluding voters from primaries is. Again, what this fundamentally comes down to is, and the fundamental issue, is including all people in an election to elect people that are more capable of representing their entire district. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Senator Westland. Are there questions? Thanks a lot.
Thank you, sir. You're
always welcome here. Okay, we're going to now bring on a panel. Former Secretary of State and State Representative Phil Kiesling is here, and like John Ledger and Paul Kelly to join him, please.
Morning, Chairman Rowe, members of the committee. I think I'll start, and then Paul and John will follow up. My name is Phil Kiesling. I live at 3408 Southeast 8th in Portland, Oregon. I do have a full-time job. I work for an information technology services company in Beaverton with about 150 people, and notwithstanding the full-time job, decided about 2 years ago in the spare time I didn't have to try to change the basic rules of Oregon politics. Along with Norma Paulus and Dick Alexander, we co-sponsored an initiative petition that did end up falling short. We needed about 14,000 more signatures. We learned some lessons along the way about signature gathering. We only had 6 months to do it because we did need to rewrite the measure to respond to a court decision, which may come up in questions. We're very confident that this measure will withstand the toughest constitutional scrutiny. But we learned a number of things along the way about this measure, and I really want to applaud Representative Girard, Representative Cannon, Senator Westland. They basically have come forward and said to you that they are willing and believe it's important to make their own personal lives more difficult, more competition in particular districts, because this is the right thing to do. Oregonians very much think it's the right thing to do. We did a poll in June of 2005 that found 61% to 33% support for this idea. But that was less remarkable than the depth and the intensity of the support for this. Almost as many people strongly supported this as somewhat supported it, which is rare among many issues. Every demographic group across the board strongly supported it. Didn't matter whether you lived, didn't matter what your gender was, didn't matter your age, but perhaps most interesting of all, it didn't matter your political philosophy or orientation. Democrats supported this in our poll by a 59% to 29% margin, Republicans 53% to 38%. Self-described liberals supported this 58% to 29%. Self-described conservatives 50% to 30%. Of course, independents and self-described moderates supported it even stronger. Even among Oregonians who said, the issue that I care about most of all will likely receive less attention in an open primary, they supported this issue, notwithstanding that. People think this is the right thing to do. It makes every voter equal, lets them vote in every election for the candidate they think will do the best job for a particular office. The primary is the only election we hold that doesn't allow you to choose from the entire field. I think it's also very revealing what we learned about how Oregon election law is actually constructed with this regard. There is literally nothing in the statutes that requires any office to be elected on a partisan basis. There is nothing that describes why an office should be. Instead, Oregon law for more than a century has been constructed to say the following offices shall be elected on a nonpartisan basis. It then lists those offices. They include judge and district attorney. Recently, we added the labor commissioner to the school superintendent. But if it's an office is not on a that particular list, it then defaults to being elected on a partisan basis implicitly. Senate Bill 630 is constructed in a fascinating way, and I think it reveals how we have basically let a century of tradition prevent a very important debate about a fundamental principle of how we govern ourselves. And that is that it has just simply been taken as a given. We simply define offices that are not elected currently on a nonpartisan basis as voter choice offices. Everybody runs, top two go to the finals, and then the winner is elected in November. I won't belabor other points, and I certainly don't believe that you ought to pass this because it's popular. I think it's important to know that. But that's not why you should pass it. You should have this debate, and I think it is one of the most interesting, fun, important debates this legislature can have in 2007 because of the dynamics that are produced by the current system. You have turnout. Last primary was 39% of registered voters. Believe it or not, it was about the highest in the country. The median age of people who actually cast a ballot was 60. Does anybody here think that that doesn't affect what gets talked about and what doesn't get talked about? That it doesn't affect how things are talked about? We have, as has been far more eloquently said than I, most of our races for the legislature today are over in May. I think we know that. That's a common knowledge in this building and in the general public. There were maybe 10, 15 competitive legislative races last time. I think this is true. I'll have to check it. I think more legislators who've been incumbents in the last 15 years have lost in their primary elections than have lost in their general elections, incumbents running for re-election. I myself won such a seat in 1988, heavily Democratic in my district. It's all I needed to do. Now, what happens in this dynamic, playing to your base, get through the primary and you've essentially won the election? Well, for one thing, you do the math. If 40% are registered in a party, I need 50% of those 40%, but if only 40% of them are voting, I need about 50% of the 40% of the 40%, which is about 16%. 50% of 16% of the electorate to win my office in many of these districts. Give or take, add a few percentage to those numbers. That's the reality. Well, when candidates know that this is the truth, what are some of the casualties? Trust, zig to one direction, zag to the rest, win your primary, and then try to get back to the middle. Some are successful, some are not. I think people do this with as much integrity as they have, and I actually do not. I'm not a cynic about why people run for office. No one is here on this panel who is here for small reasons. Every one of you is here to get important things done. But you know what the public perception is of people in this building. You say what you need to say to get elected. Contrast that with an open primary where from the get-go you run, reach out to every voter. Here is who I am and what I believe. I am so-and-so who believes the following things are important, and I happen to be a Democrat, or I happen to be a Republican. That dynamic is the open primary dynamic. What's the current dynamic? I want the Democratic nomination, or the Republican nomination. I am the Republican nominee who happens to be named so-and-so. In a world in which people are increasingly seeing this as blood sport, your side is absolutely right. The other side is absolutely wrong. In fact, it isn't just wrong. They're dull-witted ignoramuses who actually border on worse. Listen to talk radio. You get a sense of what the dialogue and the content of this is. Do we think that politics in the last 25 years has gotten less mean, more interesting, more engaging for average voters? When we polled in 2005 in this poll that I mentioned, we literally found 2 people out of 500 who gave the Oregon legislature excellent marks, rounded to 0%. You're doing a far better job than that. But the perception that in this building and outside this building, that what in the end is most important is what label you have, is, I think, deadly to not just constructive conversation about important issues, but actual progress on them. There's no one cure-all. I'm not going to pretend that an open primary is going to solve every problem that ails us and prevents these kind of debates, that doesn't allow us to make as much progress as we want on health care, tax reform, education, etc. And I'm also not going to pretend that there can't be progress in the current system. You've shown some. The rainy day fund, in my mind, is an example of progress, long overdue.
Yeah.
$250 million will melt quickly in any kind of serious downturn, but it is important. It's a step forward. But it was also really, really hard. And lest I be accused of making this a partisan argument, my own party, I think, has been guilty, I'm a Democrat, of ignoring important issues for way too long and letting them fester. The PERS issue is one, and I happen to be a PERS beneficiary. Voters are tired of the which side are you on orientation, and they also understand true competition from show competition. Sure, there's always more than one candidate in November, but is it a true contest of ideas and philosophies in any meaningful sense in the vast majority of districts? Minor party candidates, and I know they won't support this, but minor party candidates don't even get to show their case until November, and then it's in a situation where they're either going to be deemed irrelevant, they get so few votes it doesn't matter, at least they get a platform, or they run the risk of being a spoiler because they're not on an equal basis with everybody else. You may have situations where the top two candidates are both members of the same political party. But you know, if both of them are members of the same political party and they have very similar views, Republicans, both same positions on social issues, on taxes, on government, or Democrats, same issues on environmental issues or issues having to do with education, public employee union agendas, etc. If both of them are basically carbon copies, you're in a district that right now, that's over in May. That election is done for. But there are Democrats and then there are Democrats. There are Republicans and then there are Republicans. There may be a more vigorous, more meaningful debate between two Republicans in certain districts, even in those, I think, occasional situations that happen, than you have now between people who are technically of different parties. Don't confuse diversity of partisan label with diversity of true, meaningful debate about issues and how we solve these various problems. Now, a century ago, Oregon was one of the first states in the country to do something very, very, quote, radical. It decided to change the primary system. The system then was caucuses that let people be nominated and go forward. We decided that voters ought to have a say and there ought to be direct elections. The people who hated this idea predicted the end of Western civilization and vast amounts of ignorance and calamity. And, of course, within 20 years, this was the model for the entire country. The closed primary has been very useful, but it has outlived its usefulness in an era in which 25% are independent or other, and most young, the biggest single category for young voters today are none of the above. I look at everybody on this panel, and I've known and worked with many of you over the years, and I'll just close in saying this. We have an opportunity today to go from better to truly great. This is a much better session in many regards than we've seen in a while. This will be a successful legislative session, I believe. Editorial boards, and 14 of them wanted the open primary debated and on the ballot. But I think they'll generally give high marks to people on both sides of the aisle. And I think they'll do that in part because you're all tired of some of the old dynamics, and in part because voters are as well. And I think at the end of the day, most of all, because people like you are very serious about legislating. And that may even lead some of you to say, oh, we don't need this. Why do this? It's a big change. I think the reason you do it is precisely because there's hope, precisely because you've been making some progress. You know, I look around everybody here around the table. Many, some of you I've known for close to 30 years. Senator Atkinson, when I first met you, we talked about Teddy Roosevelt and the picture on the wall. Teddy Roosevelt, could he win a Republican primary today in this country, in this state? I don't think so. Senator Winters, who isn't here, met her when she worked for the Tom McCall campaign. I worked for the Tom McCall campaign, too, in a Republican primary. I was a Republican for a while. Did Tom McCall win a primary today? She voted for Measure 30. I don't think that did her very well when she ran for Congress. Senator Metzger, you and I have talked very thoughtfully about election issues. You care and think deeply about these. You know your district. Your district is a swing district. Your district is one that you cannot take a Republican or Democrat for granted. It is a district in which people, I believe, want people reaching across the aisle forging solutions, which you often have because you're an independent-minded Democrat. Senator Morse, you're an independent-minded Republican. You've taken some tough stands in a district that probably gets you in some hot water in a Republican primary. You know the dynamic of which I speak very keenly. Senator Vakian, you represent the district I grew up in, where I first canvassed for Representative Tom Marsh 30 years ago, my old high school teacher. You know that in your district, 25% of the voters are now independent, or none of the above. You know that people are tired of partisanship, but you don't have a chance to speak to as many of them when you're running in your tough races as you would like. Senator Monroe, you've been in politics for 30 years, maybe probably even longer than that. You know the dynamics about primaries. You've worked hard for things like tax reform over the years, things that it's hard to even have a conversation about, much less make progress on. And President Courtney, you and I served in the 1988 legislature together. I first met you when I was a Willamette Week reporter and you were advocating for fundamental tax reform, a sales tax. You were bucking your own Democratic Party more even than the Republican Party. If you did that today, could you survive a tough Democratic challenge as a freshman or a sophomore legislator because you basically said something in violation of the Democratic Party platform is still a good and a necessary idea? I don't see a person here today who's here to do small things, much less petty partisan things. You're here to try to make a real difference. I truly believe that changing the basic architecture of this system, yes, it will cause discomfort. Yes, it will cause some unpredictable things. There will be unintended consequences. Yes, it will mean more competition and some more difficult campaigns, perhaps for every one of you up here. But I believe it is the right thing to do because if Oregon wants to be great, if we want public policy that gets good ideas from all sides of the aisle, and that's just not two sides, that's independents, that's minor parties as well, if we want diversity of debate and opinion, I believe that changing this basic architecture is one of, if not the best way to do it. So what we're asking today, hold a work session. Debate this among yourselves. Get it to the floor so we can have this debate. And if in the end you decide this is so important that the people of Oregon ought to be part of this debate as well, then maybe it ought to go out for referral for a vote. Those of us who wanted to bring this to a vote would certainly say that's acceptable, maybe even a good idea. This is that important. And I appreciate the time to come here and testify today, and I'll let John and Paul speak as well. And then we'd love to take any questions. Thank you.
Okay. John?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning. I'm John Ledger, Vice President, Associated Oregon Industries. This issue has been one that's supported by our board. Historically, we have a 65-member board from all over the state. They've endorsed this. Our PAC board has endorsed this. I think we were the first comprehensive business association to actually back this initiative, and we actually helped fund the measure that ran last November, and we worked actively on it. We were sorry to see it didn't get enough signatures. We see this primarily as a good government issue. And one of the things I wanted to, that I think is important to say, is we see Oregon as having good government, especially when you look at some of the states on the eastern side of the country. Oregon, most of the western states have very good government. We see this as something that makes it better. We see this as something that will allow more, encourage more people to run. We think there'll be better choices. It'll give the voters better choices, and we think that will result in better government. The partisanship issue is always interesting because people benefit on that depending on year to year and what happens in the elections. The partisanship issue here, really, the change derives from having to run in a district and essentially get votes from both parties. It doesn't prohibit partisanship or forming any type of caucus within the body after you're elected. You can still have Democratic and Republican caucuses, just like we have now. Partisanship, I think, frankly, I think the public overemphasizes what it does. The way this country and state set up, partisanship in the United States and in states is much, much less than you find in most democracies where they actually run on parties. In some cases, that's all you vote for. But we see this as something that will encourage people to run. We think we'll get a broader variety of candidates, and it's something we would certainly support being put out for a vote again. Thank you.
Thank you. Paul?
Good morning, Chairman Monroe, Vice Chair Morris, members of the committee. My name is Paul Kelly. I live in Northeast Portland, practice law in Portland with the firm Garvey Schubert Bear. But today I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Business Association as a member of its Good Government Committee and as a past board member and past chair of OBA. Thank you for the opportunity to present this morning. I'll be very brief and essentially am going to echo Mr. Ledger's comments. On behalf of OBA, I'm pleased to lend our strong support to this concept of open voter choice primaries that are contained, that is contained in these two bills. Furthering this concept of open primary elections is a principal action item of OBA's current legislative agenda. And it's fully consistent with what is a fundamental principle of operation of OBA, and that is for bipartisan, balanced approach to state policymaking. We believe that such reform of Oregon's election process is a vital step toward decreasing institutional partisanship, increasing the effectiveness of this legislature, and restoring public trust in all of Oregon's key elected officials. Now, the list of reasons why one might support these two bills, I think Mr. Kiesling laid out in great detail and eloquently, and they go beyond even what OBA might identify. But I think at the heart of the measure, or the measures, is the opportunity of every Oregon voter, regardless of party affiliation or the absence of the affiliation, to exercise an essential right of citizenship to vote for the candidate that he or she believes will best represent that voter's interests. And at a time in our state's history when nearly one in every four voters is an independent, the open primary mechanism would certainly increase voter participation in primary elections and likely lead to a greater reflection of the moderate values held by most Oregonians. OBA believes that the electorate has made it clear that it wants to see less partisan politics that too often plague our election process. And as the makeup of Oregon's electorate becomes more diverse and the business community along with it, reduction of such limited interest partnership is necessary if we're to have effective governance of the state. So in summary, OBA wholeheartedly supports this open primary election process and this legislation, and I thank you for the opportunity to present.
Thank you. Are there questions for this panel?
I have one, Mr. Chair.
Senator Bakke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I have a premise to my question, which any of you should challenge if you think it's wrong, because it'll be helpful in analyzing this. Even if this were to pass, it seems to me that most of the attention would still be placed on the November election rather than the primary election, that most of the attention from the press, the voter turnout probably would still be higher, might be closer, but still be higher. And so the November election really is still the showcase election. And it seems likely that in 70 or 80% of the districts around the state, you'll end up with the point that you touched on, Mr. Kiesling, which is that you'll end up with two Democrats running in November against each other, or two Republicans running against each other, and that the result of that will be that on the biggest election stage you have, you will be excluding minor parties and minority parties, Republicans in Portland or Eugene maybe, and Democrats in other parts of the state, from being able to express their philosophies or even have a chance at winning the election in a general election. So I have a concern that this actually results in an exclusion of public debate rather than an inclusion.
Right. Well, Senator Bakken, I think it's a terrific question and one that probably deserves more, in a sense, discussion and analysis than virtually any other in this, because that would be certainly a danger if you ran this for a couple cycles and as you said, 70-80% are the same, more so they're similar, Tweedledee, you know, Tweedledum, same, saying the same things. There's really no diversity even of opinion among that. But where I would challenge the premise is in several ways. First of all, the minute this passes, Oregonians no longer are required to register as a Democrat or a Republican in order to have any kind of say in the first round. States that have far more liberal primary laws are now reaching 40 or even 50% or more of voters are registered as independents. Okay. We think Oregon is one of the highest in the country. It's actually not. In fact, 21 states don't even have party registration at all. So you would give people freedom to register how they want. So I believe that number then would even get higher. Okay. So secondly, the premise that 70 or 80% would be of the same party. I just think that's way too high. I think it would happen. But I think in many, if not most of the cases where it would happen, you would have diversity of opinion among the two people that make the finalists. And again, compare it to the current system, where people know in 85% of those districts the race is the primary. And the other point I'd add is you say about interest in the election. I do agree with you that turnout would go up. If you look at the May 2006 primary election, about 40 to 45% of Republicans and Democrats actually cast a ballot. Most even of the primaries weren't competitive. And about 25% of independents did. Now, 25% of independents who still cast a ballot, that's, I think, is a pretty healthy sign in some ways. They did it even though they were excluded from many things. At least they could vote for judges. But I think independents in particular would go up significantly. And remember, there is no one election that is held. I mean, if you stop and think about it, there are hundreds of individual elections that are held. And levels of interest can vary widely depending on candidates that are running and the issues they make of it. Now I'll speak to the minor party issue as well, because I think it's very important and you're going to hear testimony on this. I think there's an exquisite dilemma if you're a member of the minor party. On one hand, you know that 14 out of 15 people who decide not to register with the Democrats or Republicans don't register with the minor party. They say none of the above. I'm not protesting that the Democrats or Republicans aren't the right party. I'm protesting I don't want to belong to parties. Okay. But they right now have access to the ballot that's guaranteed, and if 26 people get in a room together and nominate somebody to be governor, that name is going to go on the ballot on an equal standing with Democrats and Republicans. Wow, a platform. I can talk and I can fight to get a debate, but at least I'll be heard. I'll get the newspaper articles, etc. It's a good thing. And you risk giving that up. But what do you gain? You gain relevance. You gain the ability in a district to make your case. I truly believe, and I know this will be disagreed with, I believe there are districts in Portland where a Pacific Green Party member gets the 25% in the May round and now has a chance to actually win the office, not just be on the ballot. Okay, I believe that by going to voters and saying, I am no longer a spoiler, I'm on an equal basis, I have a chance to build that party. What's the mission statement of a party? I think it's to win. I don't think it's to simply have a platform to debate. I believe in certain more conservative parts of Oregon that a libertarian may end up running against the Republican. There's a diversity of opinions. It may not be the diversity that I might prefer. I happen to be a Democrat. But there's a diversity of opinions between that, not just within parties, but between some of those. Again, what's the challenge for a non-Republican or a non-Democrat in the open primary is to get to the finals, is to get enough votes in a 3 or a 5 or even a 10-person field, because here are my ideas, and even though I happen to be a Libertarian, a Pacific Green, a member of the Independent Party, pick a name, new parties can be created all the time, I have the following positions, and I think they appeal to far more than just my own kith and kin. That's why I think that the trade-off of having only 2 names in November, but having that May election and the chance to have a meaningful debate where there's competition at that local level, and I think far more races will be truly competitive, that is not just a net plus, but a significant net plus in terms of the diversity of opinion and debate. Now, again, reasonable people will disagree on this. People may feel as strongly in the other direction and have a chance to make their case. But never forget the comparison to what is. Not what you hope is, not what the political science textbooks say is a competitive, diverse election. What is? My 1988 election maybe wasn't typical, or 1990 re-election, but in a heavily Democratic district, my opponent was cited once at a bar in Southeast Portland where he told somebody who I knew, yeah, I'm the Republican nominee for House District 12. Couldn't get him to a debate, couldn't do anything other than read his voter pamphlet statement. Yeah, there were 3 people, I think, on the ballot that year, him and another party member. But look at the status quo and ask, do we think on balance this will improve that substance of that debate and do it far more often than what we have now? But a great question and a great thing to ponder.
Other questions? Thank you very much, gentlemen. We appreciate your input.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator Deckert.
You don't want to press the button?
Oh, okay. Okay, then our next panel will be George Hutchison, Blair Bobier, and Steve Geiger. Mr. Hutchison, you can start.
I'm going to go first. I signed up last, I know that.
Your name and for the record and so on, please.
Okay, my name is George Hutchison. I live at 44 Southwest Brook Street in Newport. I couldn't understand why it was that you all wanted to have a hearing at 7:15 in the morning, other than perhaps to discourage people from coming. I wondered about this commitment to democracy that this legislation seems to
Mr.
entail.
Hutchison, I will answer that. We were meeting at 10:30 on Wednesdays, and then the Senate President decided to hold floor sessions at that time, and we had a choice. We could either have this hour or 5 o'clock on Friday.
Ah, that's a tough choice. I understand. Not that I necessarily appreciate it anymore, but I understand. I think everybody thinks the idea of an open primary is excellent. I'm an old civics teacher, U.S. government, American political theory, even instructed for a while at the college, university level. And I think open primaries will absolutely do what most of the speakers here today have indicated. It will encourage those who are not registered to participate, or not registered with political parties to participate. But this bill has a poison pill in it. And it's still premised on the way of business as usual. Well-funded candidates have well-advertised campaigns, and they attract the greatest amount of attention, and people have the greatest amount of knowledge about them. Unless you are willing to link this legislation with several other critical pieces, this becomes an undemocratic, a diminishment of choices that American citizens and Oregonians would have in our elections. And here's why. If there are, for example, 8 or 9, 6, 4, 7 people in a primary, typically the ones who are best funded are going to get the most votes. And then it all comes down to the top two, not the top three or the top four. It seems like two is a very arbitrary number, folks. If we want to be making real choices, then open primary must be linked with two other things. It must be linked with campaign finance reform, and it must be linked with what is known as instant runoff voting, where voters get to really make a choice, where you can guarantee now that the voters will feel an ownership of the results of that election. If I get the vote for my first, second, and third choice, I've got a pretty good chance of one of those three choices being the candidate, or one of the two candidates. But if I only get one choice, and my candidate gets 12%, how do I in any way own the election any more than I do right now when I can't participate in a primary? That's my question for you all. And I hope you really consider it deeply, because this top two part of it is the poison pill. Open primaries, beautifully democratic in concept.
Other questions for the witness? Okay, thank you very much. Blair Beaubier.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Senators. My name is Blair Beaubier. I teach political science at Western Oregon University as an adjunct. I do a fair amount of research and writing about elections. I've been a candidate for state and federal office here in Oregon, and I'm here today representing the Pacific Green Party. Legislation before this committee would establish a top two election system. It's often mistakenly referred to as an open primary. That's incorrect. That is a different system altogether. Open primaries are used in Hawaii, Idaho, and Montana. It's a different system. You go to the polls, and on that day, you get to decide which party's primary you can participate in, regardless of your party affiliation or lack thereof. It can either be done by secret ballot, or you go and you ask for a particular one. The flaws of top two are many, and the benefits are speculative at best. What I'd like to ask the committee and the backers of this is, where else is top two used, and where has it been used successfully? We know that it was declared unconstitutional in Washington. That case apparently is making its way to the Supreme Court. It was used in Louisiana. And in terms of producing moderates, it's interesting to note that David Duke, twice won, made his way into the top two in Louisiana. I think one of my primary objections to this bill is that it limits voters' election day choices to just two. Now, in Afghanistan and in Iraq, voters can, on election day, choose from scores of candidates. And I think it's rather ironic that here in Oregon, in the United States of America, we are looking at diminishing our election day choices. That's absolutely unacceptable to me. You can go out and get 57 flavors of ice cream. You can get hundreds of channels of digital television. Why is it for the most important civic choice that we have, we would be limited to two choices? I find that anti-democratic and objectionable. I also think that it does little to represent people if we have either two Republicans or two Democrats in one race. How is that offering people a choice? One very disturbing thing about the way this top two system is structured is that it would change the outcome of elections. Jesse Ventura would not have been elected governor of Minnesota if this system were in effect. He was polling about 3% in the primaries. Campaigns and elections have their own rhythms and paces. Most people don't even wind up paying attention to campaigns until the last couple of weeks of October. The first Green Party legislator elected in the United States, Audie Bach in California, polled about 8% at the point in the primary. She too would not have been elected under the system. Top two system would make elections longer and more expensive, as though they weren't long enough and expensive enough now. Right now, people have to basically gear up for a small election, which, as some people pointed out, in some cases is a given for the primary, and then the real election happens in November. What would happen under a top two system is the real election, as it were, or maybe there'd be a first general election held in May, which means several months earlier than already planned, people would have to start raising money and start running for office. It would move things back that much longer. Perhaps the most serious flaw here is that top two would basically eliminate third parties and grassroots candidates. And we have track records where we can look at this. This isn't speculative. Richard Winger, the editor and publisher of Ballot Access News, analyzed about 800 races that took place in California and Washington under a blanket primary. Now, blanket primaries were all candidates were on the same ballot, and voters get to vote regardless of party affiliation. And what happens is, unlike top two, the top vote-getter in each party advances to the general election. Might be something to consider, or a variation thereof. But you can look at what happened in the blanket primary and see where third parties placed to determine how they would fare under a top two system. The result of Mr. Winger's analysis of over 800 races, where Democrats and Republicans were on the ballot with third party candidates, the Democrat and Republican always came in first. 800 races, not one minor party candidate advanced to the general election. I think this top two system would disenfranchise the very people it's purporting to help, independent voters. What kind of choice is it to say to independent voters, come on in, vote in the primary, but then in what amounts to a closed general election, have your choice. Do you want two Republicans or two Democrats? Or would you like a Republican and a Democrat? Where will be the minor party candidates? Where will be the independent candidates? This will clamp down and reduce people's choices, and it will hit the independent voters the hardest. Another anti-democratic portion of this proposal is that our election choices would wind up in a tiny segment of the electorate. As has been said, turnout in the primary was 39%. If you stack all the candidates in one race and divide up the vote, what's it going to take to advance to the general election? There were 11 candidates, major party candidates for governor in this last election. There were three minor party candidates, 14 candidates vying for 39% of the registered voters. If you have 14 candidates, it only takes less than 10% to advance to the general election. 10% of 39% of whatever percent, and you're going to wind up with just a tiny percentage of Oregonians making the choices of who appears on the November ballot for everyone else. There are much better ways to encourage voter participation, reduce partisanship, and ensure majority rule. And I think that's why we wind up with just two candidates in November under this, to ensure that there's a majority. Instant runoff voting. There's a bill that was sent to the House floor with a due pass committee. House Bill 2761 would let Oregon local jurisdictions use instant runoff voting, which has been part of our Constitution since 1908. It's a much better way to reduce partisanship and to produce candidates from the parties that have the support, the broader support of the broader base. If you used instant runoff voting and it ensures that a winner has a majority support in the primaries, you can't have candidates playing to one side or the other. They have to appeal to a majority of voters. Using instant runoff in a primary or in the general election is a much better solution. I would say that until the bill's proponents can counter the factual analysis done by Ballot Access News demonstrating that third parties are shut out under top two legislation, that we should operate under the assumption that this disenfranchises third parties. And I'll point out that, and to my knowledge, no third parties have been consulted about this, not in the drafting of this, not in the drafting of the initiative, not before the commission, and not in this current legislation. So I think we should call an ace here. This is not an open primary. That's a whole different animal. It's a top two system, and it will basically eradicate third parties in Oregon. Everything that this legislation attempts to accomplish can be done in a better, more efficient, and more elegant way, particularly with instant runoff voting. If the backers of this initiative want to put it back out on the street and try and qualify it, power to them. I don't think it's for the legislature to take something that's been declared unconstitutional in another state that has failed to make the ballot and put it, turn it into law. So I would just say, in conclusion, on behalf of the thousands of members of the Pacific Green Party of Oregon and the thousands of more people who support our candidates in the general election, I urge you to reject this ill-advised legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Geiger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and esteemed senators. I'm very honored to be able to speak to you today, and got up at 5 o'clock and called in late to work and rushed down here from Portland, not because I thought it'd be fun, but because I thought it was very important that you hear.
Mr. Geiger, we need you to give us your name and address for the record.
My name is Steve Geiger, and I'm living in Portland, Oregon at 4804 Southeast Knapp Street. I'm currently acting secretary of the Pacific Green Party, and while I'm proud to represent the Pacific Green Party here today, I'm really here today as an advocate for democracy. And make no mistake about it, this legislation is an affront to democracy. I like to refer to this proposal as the Measure 37 of electoral reforms. It sounds good on the surface until you have to deal with the fallout of what it will actually create. In a utopian world, open primaries might be a step in the right direction as we continue to fine-tune our democracy. But as you gentlemen are certainly aware, we do not live in a utopian world. We live in one of only five states that have no campaign spending limits, despite the passage of a recent ballot measure that required campaign spending limits. We live in a state where six figures is required to run a credible campaign just for the state house. We live in a state where $2.5 million is required to run a credible campaign for state senate. We live in a state where partisan gerrymandering has set up strategic advantages for the two major parties. We live in a state where 50% of the eligible voters don't vote. Now we want to create a situation where even less people feel represented by their choices in November? That's reform? In addition, the top two system destroys party autonomy by allowing Democrats to choose Republican candidates and vice versa and third party candidates. All you have to do is register to a party within 70 days and you are allowed to represent yourself as being a representative of that party without any approval by the party itself. This opens up things for nefarious deeds and people doing things that are negative towards the party. But perhaps most importantly is that it severely limits the campaign season for any party that cannot compete monetarily with the big box parties. Senator Avakian, your premise was exactly correct, and as you heard, the reply to it was woefully inadequate. As campaign coordinator for the Joe Keating for Governor campaign, I can't express to you how important it was for our campaign and the growth of our party to be able to campaign from the Pacific Green Party convention in April all the way to November. We had 6 months to get our message out, to travel the state, to talk to people, to let them know about the party. We registered many voters. A lot of people found out about the party that they didn't know about, that they wouldn't have the chance to in this top two system. We're cheated out of months of campaigning, which is vital if a third party is going to grow and become more viable. Many people did not even know much about our party, and that's why it makes the outreach that these campaigns offer that much more important. And I'm sure nobody here on this panel committee doubts the power of money in elections, but if anybody does, I challenge them to look at the facts. And, for example, look at Money in Politics Research Action Project, which shows that 85% of Oregon legislative races were won by the person who raised the most money. And in the other 15%, they were reasonably close in fundraising. The 2006 governor's race offers a clear example of what would take place in a top two primary. The Democratic candidate, Ted Kulongoski, raised about $5.3 million. Ron Saxton raised nearly $9 million. And by contrast, Constitution Party Mary Sterrett raised $48,000, while Joe Keating raised a little over $3,000 and Richard Morley raised a little over $5,000. Is there any mistake of what would have happened in this year's governor's race? We would have not heard from any of these other candidates, and all of the people that they represented would not have felt any need to go to the primary to vote for somebody that didn't represent them. In addition to silencing the voices of minor parties during the most critical days, weeks, and months leading up to the general election, a top two system would require that Oregon voters who do not wish to cast a vote for the best fundraisers now not vote in the general election, resulting in less voter participation, not more, as we've heard from some of these advocates. Essentially, as George mentioned earlier, void of real campaign finance reform with teeth, void of public financing of campaigns, void of electoral reforms like instant runoff voting, implementing a top two system will destroy the growing viability of minor parties in Oregon. It destroys the voters' right to cast a vote for who they want in the general election. It magnifies instead of decreases the power of special interest money. It limits voter choice based on who is willing to do what it takes to get that special interest money. If we want to limit Oregonians' choices to those who raise the most special interest money, then I suggest that you advocate this. But I submit to you that any evaluation of this legislation that does not acknowledge the huge problem that unfettered campaign spending financing presents within the context of open primaries legislation is flawed. IRV will take care of the spoiler issue that was brought up earlier, and that's in the House right now. So as Blair mentioned, there's many ways to reform this system and make it better than it was, but this top two system, as I said, is the major 37 of electoral reforms, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Other questions? I'd just like to indicate that in the last election, and I was not the incumbent, I was outspent more than 3-1 in the primary and 5-1 in the general, and I'm here.
You're the exception to the rule, sir.
I am. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, and Richard Burke and Annette Newingham. This is the final panel, unless there's somebody else out there that wants to be heard. Oh, you're a different person?
Yes.
That was confusing. We had two Steve Geigers. Okay. Why don't you come up and join these two, and we'll hear from you as well. Okay, Mr. Burke.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Richard Burke. I live in Beaverton at 3280 Southwest 170th Street. I am the executive director of the Oregon Libertarian Party. I was a candidate for governor on the Libertarian ticket in 1999. I served on the explanation committee for the open primary initiative during the last election cycle with Senator Deckert. and representative of Phil Kiesling, and I have 17 years of experience in ballot access issues, and with the help of other senators was able to get Senate Bill 777 and 747 passed into law in 2001. It's interesting. The people who have backed this bill tell us it's good for third parties. I don't know if that's a big concern to you, but it kind of reminds me of when you offer a dog biscuit to a dog to get him into the car. Problem is, the dog doesn't know he's being taken to the vet to be euthanized. And as Mr. Beaubier said before, we were never consulted on this at all. We were never asked to provide our input in writing. After I served on the explanation committee, I made it known that we would like to be involved if this is drafted into a bill. Never got a phone call. I spoke with Norma Paulus outside of Senator Deckert's office when she was meeting with him on this. Gave her my contact information. No call. So there has just been no involvement here. I'm going to show in my testimony today that this is not only unfair at a legal level, but also a bad bill for Republicans and Democrats, too.
And, Mr. Burke, we're down to about 7 minutes left till we have to adjourn, so if you could be
okay,
as brief
I'll speed
as possible,
it up.
We'd
I'll
appreciate
speed it, up.
It.
Okay, first of all, on the bill, line 17, it says precinct committee chairpersons will be elected in the primary for major party precinct committee chairpersons. If this is about equality, why cannot minor parties elect their precinct committee chairpersons in the primary? Mr. Kiesling said this was supposed to put everyone on equal footing. It does not. We have precinct committee chair people. Why can't we elect ours in the primary? And it shows that there's still going to be a partisan ballot. Next, for president and vice president, major parties still get to select their nominees in the primaries. We do not. You know, libertarians have presidential primaries in 12 other states. We would not be able to do this. There are other issues, too, relating to the bill, but I can talk to you about that offline.
Thank you.
What this is going to do for the Republicans and Democrats, it's going to make the selection, it's going to take the candidate selection process and drive it underground. If you have a Democratic district, one Republican candidate and three Democratic candidates, you risk dividing up the Democratic vote in such a way that I guess the numbers of combinations would be different. But what you're going to end up doing is you're going to have Democrats saying, okay, who do we want to run? Who are we going to back? And you're going to see a lot of the chucking and jiving taking place in back rooms before the primary to decide who is going to be the bill. I want to close up here because I want to allow time for
and you can
here.
And you can also submit full written testimony and we'll consider that. Just
yeah.
Give that to our clerk.
Okay, but you know, this is a disingenuous bill if it does not treat all parties equally. And I submit that the fact that we cannot use the process to select our precinct committee chair people, and we do not have access to the primary ballot for our presidential election candidates, and several other things relating to how you remain a minor party on the ballot. It makes this an inherently unfair bill that we were not allowed to participate in, and I hope you kill this bill. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Nottingham.
Yes. Annette Newingham, Lane County Elections Official. I'm here on behalf of the Association of County Clerks. We're neutral on the bill, and I'll be very brief. We just wanted to point out a particular area in Section 33, which we were a little concerned about, that the way it's written, it would create two ballots to be sent. And we have some suggested language that I have talked to Secretary Kiesling about that would amend that and make it be able to be on one page. So if it goes into work session, please consider those suggested language changes.
Thank you very much.
Thank
and we
you
certainly
for allowing
will.
Me to talk.
And Mr. Geiger the second.
Steve Lance Geiger, 20943 Northwest Windstone Court, Beaverton, Oregon. I don't have anything prepared, so I'll keep my comments brief. Basically, I thought this was important enough to come down here today, so I'm here on behalf of many others who couldn't make it at this hour. I thought it was important enough to take the day off work. Basically, as a younger voter, I just wanted to express that I feel very disenfranchised with the current electoral system. I don't feel any of my views are represented by the major parties, and is one of the reasons why I am a big fan of minor parties and allowing them to participate in the general election. I think this bill would be, in my opinion, disastrous to minor parties. I'd like to echo many of the statements that have already been made, and I just think as a many younger voters are in the same boat as me, where they don't feel their views are represented by any of the big parties, and if we were to only put on the top two people in the general election, I think what we would see is many of the younger voters simply wouldn't vote. And it's not because we're lazy or don't feel interested. We are politically active, but if we don't feel our views are represented, we will have really no feasable choice to pick come November. That's all I had. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Let me tell you kind of where I'm going to head with this issue. This is an important issue. It's an issue that I also, by the way, have been a government and American history teacher and professor all my life. And so I've thought about this besides being in elected politics for 30 years. I'm going to ask that both the Democratic and Republican caucuses here, and I'll also touch base with the single independent in the Senate, and find out where the votes are and whether or not people want me to pursue this or some form of an open primary. If the votes are not here in the Senate, then I would suggest to Mr. Kiesling and others that they go back and get some more signatures next time, because I think it is an important issue that Oregonians ought to have an opportunity to weigh in on. My preference would be if the legislature constructs the bill that it be in the form of a referendum, and we let the voters be heard on it. But I don't know if there are even the votes to do that, frankly. I've heard considerable opposition. And so we'll be asking Senator Morse, the vice chair of this committee, to go back to the Republican caucus and count heads, and I'll be doing the same in the Democratic caucus along with Senator Deckert and others, and we'll find out where the votes lie. There are, as we heard today in an hour and a half of, or hour and a quarter of testimony, there are passionate people on both sides of this issue, and in fact there are many forms of open primary that we could look at. There are adjustments we could make. This bill, as written, probably is not constitutional because of the Washington case. The courts up there and our legislative council have suggested that there are some legal problems with the way it is actually drafted currently that would have to be dealt with as well. So that's kind of where we're at, and I want everybody to understand that. I will not be scheduling this bill for a work session until and unless we hear that there's a majority of senators that want to move forward with some form of it. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, we are adjourned.